This is the Education Gadfly Show.
She's just shown herself to be very strong, to be, you know, just like you're strong. The Common Core debate.
Good one.
All right.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Katie Holmes of Education Policy, Kathleen Porter McGee.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me again.
Good. I don't even really know what that analogy means at all.
I don't either.
You're not getting a divorce.
I'm not sure it's a compliment, but...
Yes. I mean, you are a part of a celebrity marriage in education.
Because that's
true. Your husband, also in education policy, Mark, leading 50 Can, but you are not getting divorced. Thank goodness. But you know, you're like Katie, who many people thought... well, she's just shown herself to be very strong, to be, you know, just like you're strong in the Common Core debate.
Good one.
All right. Anyways, yes. Hey, you know, it is fun to think about. I hope they do a poll that says how many people have been paying attention to the, you know, Tom Cruise, Katie Holmes divorce more so than the healthcare Supreme Court decision. And I would suspect it would be more.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure that's true.
Because it's more fun. There's something about seeing celebrities having a hard time that makes people happy. You don't agree? You
know? I don't know. I guess so. I mean, something about just watching celebrities and being mesmerized by sometimes their stupidity that I think makes people happy.
All right. No, it is sad. I never like to see a marriage break up, especially when children are involved.
Right.
Regardless of what kind of strange religions might be involved. Okay. Hey, lots to cover. It's the summer, but still, things are happening. We got things to debate. So Ty is going to lead us with Pardon the Gadfly, and then we're going to hear Amber's Research Minute. The Education Gadfly podcast marches on through these warm summer months. Ty, get us started.
The Department of Education has now exempted more than half of the states from some requirements of the No Child Left Behind Act. What are the risks of this patchwork approach to accountability?
Well, look, I mean, we know the risks are that certain schools that would be labeled as failing or having problems in one state won't be so labeled in another, because there are going to be more differences now than before. Though the differences are more subtle than people make it out to be. And I think the coverage on this keeps missing the basic point, which is that the Department of Ed's not given all that much discretion to the states.
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, and also, I guess I don't understand exactly how they're going to enforce this. So they've got 27, I guess, different things to enforce. The 26 different waiver applications, mm-hmm. plus everybody who's going to be governed by No Child Left Behind still. And how is that going to work? Also, I'm not convinced they've learned the right lessons from No Child Left Behind. It still seems like they're being pretty top down, just in slightly different ways.
Oh yeah, no, I mean these accountability systems are not dramatically different than what we've had before in most cases. I mean, you get rid of the 2014 deadline, you get mm-hmm. rid of universal proficiency. Those are big deals, but in terms of the subgroups and the way that a lot of these schools get labeled as needing improvement, you're still going to have a lot of schools out there who the state are going to be saying are failing to make the bar, even if they're making big progress on student achievement, even if they're showing big gains. You know, because of the way the administration has gone about this. Look, here's what I think the big risk is, and that keeps me up at night. Well, not really, but if education policy did keep me up at night, this would mm-hmm. be it, is around teacher evaluations. Mm-hmm. You know, that we now have, 26 states that have agreed to do some kind of statewide teacher evaluation system. We are learning more and more every day about how risky this process is. And it's risky both because the measures are still iffy on value added, but also because we are now forcing states to say that their schools not only have to worry about getting test scores up because of their school grade, but now individual teachers have to worry about getting test scores up because of their teacher evaluation ratings. And I worry that this means that we're just killing any attempt to have educational pluralism and diversity. In other words, schools that can say, hey, we're not going to do that well on the test, but we don't care because, you know, we're just not into standards-based education. We're into something else mm-hmm. that's harder and harder to do. By the way, I think in most of these states, charter schools have to be a part of this. Mm. I mean, this is crazy, right?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the teacher evaluation piece is huge. And I think that people are going to be up in arms when the implementation comes down the road.
I mean, you are a big fan of the whole tight, loose paradigm, and you've mm-hmm. made a case for it here on the show. I mean, this is getting in the way. I mean, this is basically mm-hmm. saying, now we're saying, okay, not only are we going to judge you by whether or not your overall test scores are well and then leave you alone, we're going to judge you by those test scores, and we're going to micromanage the way you manage your teaching staff.
Right, exactly. And also, I mean, there's a question about whether the states should be in that at all. At least No Child Left Behind was, the accountability was focused on the school level. Getting it down to the individual teacher level, that just takes so much autonomy away from school and district leaders. And I don't know what that's going to do to leadership requirements and the kind of leaders that we're going to want and need.
Topic number two, Ty.
While charter schools may soon enroll more students than the district schools in D.C., charter school growth has stalled in communities surrounding the capital. Do the suburbs deserve charters too?
You know, this is a big debate around the country. We know that some of the early charter school states like Minnesota and California, Colorado, have lots of suburban charter schools serving middle class kids. But the later states on the charter movement tend to focus on the urban areas. And now there's a debate. Should we open it up further? In New Jersey, there was a big debate in the legislature this year. Now these debates in the D.C. suburbs. I mean, look, and you always have the affluent suburban district saying, hey, we are a great district. Our parents are happy. Right? You hear that from, look, I heard that personally from the superintendent of Montgomery County Public Schools, Josh Starr, who said, look, people don't want charter schools here. These are, I mean, that's a district of 140,000 kids. You're telling me every single one of those parents agrees on educational philosophy and approach, and they want the exact same kind of school for their kids? That's nuts.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, everybody deserves choice. Everybody, and every school, I think, can benefit from having some level of healthy competition. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me to say that the only places that we can innovate are in urban areas or with schools that are serving disadvantaged students. I mean, parents of advanced students, parents of average students, they may want to have different options that differ from whatever their traditional public school is offering. It seems crazy to me to limit options, especially public school options.
I mean, you look at D.C. and you look at the huge now variety that parents have to choose among. I mean, it's overwhelming, but you're going to have a Mandarin language immersion school, a Spanish language immersion school, a Spanish language immersion school that's also a Montessori school. You can have an environmentally focused school. I mean, all these different things, right? And you're telling me that the parents in Montgomery County or out in Virginia would not like those choices too, some of those choices? You know, why are we so focused on having schools be so uniform? And this links back to what the first topic again, which was, you know, by mandating not just the loyalty towards the state tests when it comes to state report cards, but now on teacher evaluations, this movement to try to make our schools the same. You know, why are we so afraid of giving parents a choice and letting schools be different and having different kinds of, you know, flavors out there? I mean, even if you're Montgomery County Public Schools, you may not benefit much, say, from the competition of choice, but you should at least say, hey, our parents are very diverse. They've got lots of different interests out there. Let's try to provide different things that they might want.
I also think, though, I think we shouldn't lose sight of the competition thing. I mean, I do think that, I mean, are we sure that even our highest performing districts are serving their students the best that they possibly can, that we can't benefit from any innovation at all? I mean, I think that looking at any problem, whether it's how to serve our most advanced students or even how to serve just the average 14-year-old, looking at it for a different way or taking a different tack, that can only benefit students in the end. And to say that there's only one right way to do it, or to say that the status quo has gotten it exactly perfect, I think is a little bit naive.
Well said, Kathleen. Okay, topic number three.
An estimated 500 public schools now offer single-sex education, up from about a dozen a decade ago. Is this increase an encouraging trend?
I mean, to me, I'm not sure it's encouraging or discouraging. To me, it all goes back to that question of choice. Parents that want to have single-sex options for their kids, I think giving them the option to send their children to single-sex schools is good. I think mandating it as a policy prescription, I think that gets a little bit dangerous. But again, I think having different options and different kinds of schools to serve the needs of different kinds of students is an encouraging trend.
Yeah, and this is not a mandate. I mean, look, what happened was that during the Bush administration, and I was a little bit involved in this, we changed the regulation to allow for these single-sex schools. This was called upon in No Child Left Behind by Hillary Clinton, among others. And what the regulation said was that nobody can be forced into these single-sex schools or classrooms. And if you offer this program, you got to offer for, you know, one for boys, one for girls. And there's got to be something comparable if you want the co-ed experience. So there are still, you know, it's not anything goes. But I think it's incredibly encouraging. Look, David Brooks had a fantastic column on Friday where he was writing about the crisis with boys. You know, we now have many college campuses where 60% of the students are women. Some college campuses giving affirmative action to men in order to get those numbers up. I mean, boys are doing terribly, and this might help some boys, for example, to be able to learn environments that aren't so antithetical to what it's like to be a boy. So, you know, if you want to have an all-boys school where there's more focus on competition and there's more focus, you know, that the curriculum is tweaked in some ways that might be more appealing to boys. Again, if some parents want that for their kids in a public school setting, as long as these other, you know, rules are followed, I think it's fantastic. And to have the ACLU out there using these arguments that go back 30 or 40 years about how this is going to create stereotypes, I think it's ridiculous. And I think it ignores a lot of evidence that we really are in the middle of a serious crisis for the boys. And this is a crisis that's definitely most serious in our urban areas, but it's pretty serious throughout the entire society as well.
The one thing, I was with you until you said the curriculum could be tweaked based on gender, and the one thing that I would say is that it does make me a little bit nervous to think about having different curriculum or different expectations for boys and girls schools. I mean, especially, let's just even think about an average ELA classroom. Okay, what are the kids going to be reading? Are we now saying that we want to make sure we're getting the interest level right for boys versus girls, and what is that going to mean? So I think that you can get into a little bit of a dangerous area there, but again, that is on... the curriculum level, I think having the option on the school level is certainly a value add for a lot of kids.
Okay, well said. That's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Did you take any break at all for the 4th of July?
The 4th of July. But other than that, I was holding the fort down here.
Amber, I think Woo. The only person here at the Fordham Institute working all
There were actually, I think, four of us.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Commitment. Kind of, I love it.
And I went to Gary's office, and he had his fan on. I'm like, Gary, what you doing with the fan? He's like, well, there's only four. I feel like I feel bad having the AC on with just four of us here. I'm like, buddy, you can sweat out in your office, but I got the AC on.
Yeah. All right. So what are we talking about today?
We are talking about the census data. Woohoo! Party on. Latest census data relative to the finances of K-12 public schools.
So don't denigrate this. This is exciting.
This is exciting stuff. Yeah. I mean, 2010 fiscal year data. Okay. Lots of interesting stuff. See the script, huh?
Lots of interesting stuff.
The headline, first of all, is that for the first time in 16 years, local governments picked up a higher share of the education tab than the states by a sliver. State funding decreased by 6.5% from the previous year, the biggest decrease since the Census Bureau began publishing the report in 1977. That drop was accompanied by an unprecedented increase in federal funding, a la stimulus dollars, that in many cases, as we know, propped up the state spending. All told, education funding across the country increased by 0.5%, while per pupil funding increased by 1.1%. In terms of revenues, there's a lot of data here, but it's interesting. The U.S. public education system took in roughly $594 billion, of which $74 billion came from the feds, $258 billion from the states, $261 billion from the locals. So in terms of percentages, that's about 12% from the feds, 43% states, 44% localities. The system spent, however, $602 billion. In terms of average per pupil spending nationally, the average was roughly $10,600 in 2010, which is up from about $5,000 in 1992. As for per pupil expenditures, D.C. still takes the cake, roughly $18,700 per pupil. Revenues, however, are at $27,200. D.C., this is like you dig into the appendix, you know, which is kind of fun. D.C. actually had a 13.8% increase in per pupil spending from 2009 to 10. So when you look at sort of state by state, you see these sort of interesting nuances. Utah is the lowest at 6,000 per pupil. There are a bunch of data in there for individual school districts, if our listeners care about that. But it's going to be interesting, right, to see the 2011 data when all the federal stimulus stuff is out of there.
You know, there's been a lot of blog traffic on the D.C. numbers. You know, Andrew Colson at Cato saying that if you dig into the numbers, the D.C. number is $29,000 per pupil. $29,000.
But revenues, right?
I guess that's revenues and spending. I don't know what all that counts, but it's an incredible amount of money. I don't know how that works. That must be coming largely from the federal government.
Yeah, I know.
Wow,
I know.
That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money.
I mean, yes, private schools cost that much in D.C., but not all of them. And
yeah, you can get private schools for less than that for sure.
Definitely. Yeah, so is the guess that in 2011 we might see this first dip in actual spending? Is that, is that what's anticipated?
You would think. I mean, how could we not, you know?
And the shift to the locals, I mean, this must not be good for equity, right?
Right. I mean, obviously, because that's one thing I didn't have time to do was to dig in to sort of look at the wealthier districts in the appendix and see what those changes look like, because they have sort of like this, you know, percentage change from year to year the past 5 years, and you kind of see. So, yeah, I mean, I think that would be an interesting thing to do is go in and look at the district level and see who held strong.
Because the idea is that, for the most part, it's better for equity if you have the state picking up a bigger part of the share,
right?
As many states have done over the long term, but now... with the recession, there was some backsliding on that front. I don't know how maybe some of the states have formulas that try to account for that to some degree. Were you surprised at all that the local funding held up? I mean, I thought we saw this huge decrease in property taxes that they would have been hurting too.
I know, you would think that. But I mean, again, you kind of got to look across at all the variances by the state, you know, in terms of looking at it state by state. I mean, I actually dug into a few, like Hawaii. I'm trying to figure out Hawaii. Hawaii got a big race to the top, right?
It did.
Didn't it get a big race?
Yeah.
So they actually, their per pupil went down like a little over 5% from 2009 to 2010.
Yeah.
So I'm just can't.
Well, like, it's just a state, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, if the state's cutting funding like other states have, there's no local funding there. To
right, because of that one district, right?
One district,
yeah, that's right. Okay. West Virginia was another head scratcher. Theories on that one. That one went up 11.2%. West Virginia, one year. So, anyway,
Kathleen, I mean, this is 2010, same year that Common Core standards get adopted. I mean, is this how big a problem is this spending cliff for the Common Core, do you think?
What do you mean? How much that states and districts are going to have to spend on the Common Core?
Just that the state, not only that, but the states and districts are, you know, are cutting, still continuing to this day, cutting. Times are tough out there. I mean, is this going to be a big problem for Common Core getting adopted?
I mean, I really feel like there's a lot of creative solutions to implementation, and I don't think it has to be the dramatic problem that a lot of people are painting it to be.
Robots? Is that what you're thinking
exactly.
Right now? Robots in the classroom?
I mean, honestly, there are so many, especially like step one, take a look at your professional development budget and decide how much of that is being spent wisely and effectively. I suspect a very small amount, and start to rethink some of that money. And I mean, I just think there are a lot of ways that you can look very critically at the budget and actually save money.
Okay, very nice. Well, folks, that was great. You know, what I love about this show is that we don't let slow summer months stop us. We just keep on plowing ahead.
That's right.
Nice to see you as ever. Until next week.
I'm Kathleen Porter McGee.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.